This episode of To the Journey is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice and help Trek.fm at the same time, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space, an international program of the nonprofit National Space Society. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter by visiting enterpriseinspace.org. And if you want to join the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode, join the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field. We look forward to seeing you there.
This is Robert Picardo, the emergency medical hologram from Star Trek Voyager, and you're listening to Trek FM.
I think it's safe to say that no one on this crew has been more obsessed with getting home than I have. But when I think about everything we've been through together, maybe it's not the destination that matters. Maybe it's the journey. And if that journey takes a little longer, so we can do something we all believe in, I can't think of any place I'd rather be, or any people I'd rather be with.
To the journey.
You're here.
To the journey.
Hello, everybody at home, and welcome. This is To the Journey. I'm your co-host, Zachary Frueling, and with me once again is...
Liam Smart.
Well, today, Suzanne is not with us. Suzanne has the phage. We were really hoping all three of us would be able to get on mic for the first time together tonight, but unfortunately, Suzanne is under the weather. It's that time of year.
Yeah, I did offer to give her my voice box, take it out, but, you know, she didn't quite fancy my voice, so she's just off for the day.
It's the 21st century. Can't we give her, like, a holographic voice or something? That's what the doctor would do if it really is the phage.
Well, yeah, he gave Neelix some holographic lungs. Why not?
He gave Dr. Pell a holographic body.
And him himself is just a hologram, so I guess, yeah, why not? You know?
So today, we are going to be discussing a topic that was suggested to us by a listener under the username Frosty Winnipeg. We don't know who you are, but we presume you love the show. But we received a topic suggestion to talk about the most game-changing episodes or moments in Voyager. And there aren't that many game-changing moments in Voyager, Liam, because of the Voyager reset button. I had a really hard time coming up with game-changing Voyager moments.
Exactly, me too. I sat down yesterday having a good old hard think about some of the possible options we can use as game changers. And other than a couple of blatantly obvious things, which I'm going to mention right now, with, you know, Seven joining in Scorpion and The Gift, there's really not that many game changers, as you say, because the reset button. Everything will just be finished at the end of the episode and never come back again. Like those poor lizard babies.
I was curious how you interpreted game-changing moments. Did you interpret it in terms of game-changing episodes that change the nature of the show? Because different characters actually have their character-defining game-changing moments for their characters, moments of crucial character development. Now, I actually didn't read it that way. I read it more in terms of game-changing moments that either change the tone of the show or change something significant in Star Trek. But we could talk about game-changing character moments as well.
Having said that, I originally thought about game-changing moments of the show, but had a little bit of difficulty thinking about that, as you said, because of the reset button. But instead, I did come up with a couple of game-changing character moments that changed the course of the natures of the characters. So I feel like we can just talk about either one of those, really. I don't think it matters too much. Everything that we mention is a game-changer one way or another.
Well, let's dive in and talk about the crucial moment that you mentioned, which I really think of as the turning point in all of Voyager, the departure of Kes and the arrival of Seven of Nine. In what I would describe as maybe it's not really a two-part episode, it's more like a three-part series, Scorpion Part 1 and 2, and then The Gift when Kes actually departs. Those three episodes are crucial dividing line in the Voyager timeline. And I think people who like Voyager really kind of fall in one of two camps. They're more Kes people, or they're more Seven of Nine people. Yeah. People like the early seasons of Voyager with Kes, or the later seasons of Voyager with Seven of Nine. Which do you fall into? I tend to fall into the later episodes camp. Not so much even because I'm more of a Seven of Nine fan than a Kes fan. I like the introspective quality that Seven of Nine brought to the show about the reflecting on the nature of what it means to be human. I thought it brought some much needed human self-awareness that was a little lacking in the early seasons of Voyager. So I like what Seven of Nine brought to Voyager, and it's not philosophical, but the more existential, introspective questions about human nature that Seven of Nine brought to the table.
Yeah, it's a tricky one because I like Seven of Nine more as a character. But that's not to say I don't like Kes, because I've said before, Kes is probably my third favourite character in the whole entire show. So it's very difficult for me to distinguish either side of that line which I prefer more, Seven of Nine and Kes.
I'm trying to remember who your favourite character was.
My main characters, Doctor and Seven, are my two favourite, followed by Kes. Yeah.
Right, okay. Yeah.
So I find it hard to draw a line between the two parts of Voyager, seasons 1 to 3 and then seasons 4 to 7, because I like Kes and Seven a lot. They are very different characters. As you say, Seven of Nine is, it does bring humanity and what it means to be human into question, or for us to question our own thoughts on it, whereas Kes could have been used that way as well. I'm firmly of the belief that Kes was completely underused, but Season 4, if I had to choose a season that was best overall, it would be Season 4. So maybe let's look at it in that case that I'm just on the side of 7.
You know, for a long time I agreed with that, and now when I look at Season 4, I actually get a little irritated by the fact that the first half of Season 4 is essentially the Seven of Nine show. Everything seems to revolve around Seven of Nine's growth and development, which is what I said I like about Seven of Nine's addition to the show. I just wish it was toned down a bit in Season 4.
Yeah, and you do get that line that appears in the last four seasons all the time of, when you liberated me from the Borg, you told me I could do X, Y, or Z, but now you're not letting me do X, Y, and Z. That particular line did wear a little bit thin after a while.
As I was thinking about Scorpion Parts 1 and 2, it occurred to me that those episodes are a game-changing set of episodes in another way. Yes, they brought Seven of Nine on board, but really they also changed our relation to the Borg. We get to see a lot more of the Borg's presence in the Delta Quadrant than we ever thought we'd get a chance to see, which was really awesome visually. But it also served to defang the Borg a bit. You know, it became almost too easy for Captain Janeway to beat the Borg, which carried, you know, into the rest of Voyager. And then the Borg seem, to me, less scary and less threatening, less overall, less menacing than the mindless zombie Borg that we see in, say, The Next Generation.
As I said last episode, I'm not convinced that Voyager neutered the Borg as much as people say they do. Yes, Janeway and the crew beat them a hell of a lot, but they're the biggest foil for them because they're in the Delta Quadrant, so they're going to have to beat them a lot because it's the show that we're watching. But we can't forget that Picard and the Enterprise E, beat them in First Contact. I'm not of the opinion that Voyager neutered or made the Borg less menacing. I was still as scared of them in Voyager as I was TNG. And when I say scared, I mean, I had a little bit of trepidation if I'd ever meet one, but, you know.
That's interesting. So, I had kind of conceived of Scorpion Parts 1 and 2 as a turning point, if not the Federation's relationship with the Borg, Voyager's relationship with the Borg. Something seems different about it. It's at least one of the major victory that Captain Janeway gets over the Borg, you know, in-game aside.
Yeah, exactly. And I guess it sort of takes the show into where we know everyone likes a particular villain. It's like the Borg worked on TNG, the Borg will work on Voyager.
Yeah, and you don't think it's a case of going to the well too much?
No, see, I thought I did it just fine. I could have had a whole season where Borg were there almost every episode. I would enjoy that.
Yeah, I could actually deal with a Borg TV show, actually. A whole series revolving around the Borg would be interesting.
Take it to Alex Kurtzman. He's doing everything else.
There we go. Add it to the list. There's so many Star Trek series coming out.
Another one that Frosty Winnipeg came up with was the fact that the Doctor ended up with the mobile emitter at the end of Future's End. Now, that was a massive game changer for not only the character, but for the amount of different stories that we could do with the show.
I didn't think about that, but you're right. So many of the interesting Doctor moments revolve around the Doctor actually not just hanging out in sickbay, but being able to navigate around with the crew, go on away missions and whatnot. And a lot of those great Doctor moments wouldn't happen if he didn't get the mobile emitter. It was almost necessary that he did. I mean, can you imagine creating a character only to realize that you've confined that character to one room? How it's an incredibly limiting concept. I can imagine that the writers were really frustrated with that.
Especially with the caliber of Robert Picardo's acting.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, having to, you know, relate to him across a view screen through the emergency medical holographic channel.
Yeah.
You can only, you know, milk that for so much drama. So I'm glad they got the Doctor out of sickbay very quickly.
Definitely. And then it was essential to his character growth. Without that mobile emitter, there would be so many things that he wouldn't have been able to do. He wouldn't have been able to be an opera singer. He wouldn't have been able to do what he did and help so many people in critical care. Like, a lot of good episodes came from the fact that that mobile emitter existed and they wrote that into the show. Notwithstanding the fact that it pretty much broke the temporal prime directive in having it from the 29th century.
Even though in Author, it's like a 50-pound albatross of a ball and chain that he wants to get rid of.
That was such an in-your-face metaphor, wasn't it, for it?
Author is actually on my list of game-changing moments, but not for that reason. It has to do with the fact that it raised this issue of holographic rights, which is now relevant again, surprisingly, in an interesting way in Star Trek Picard, the question of whether synthetics have rights or whether synthetics should be banned. I was curious whether that extended to holograms as well, but the Doctor explicitly gets the ball rolling on the question of holographic rights in Author, and I think we can see, you know, 20 years later, the poisonous fruits of that in Star Trek Picard.
Well, that makes me wish we would be seeing Robert Picardo in season one. I know he's had talks about being in season two, but if we saw him in season one, then that would obviously have really helped towards the synthetic storyline. I'm saying that as if I know what's going to happen in the show, but we've only seen one episode thus far. But
yeah, so it didn't get a chance to change Voyager per se, but I think that issue is, you know, relevant, you know, extending basic rights to every type of living being, Romulans or synthetics or androids or holograms.
Well, yeah. I mean, they're all synthetic beings, aren't they, at the end of the day? When we see all the EMH Mark 1s in the mining facility talking about Author, you just get this feeling that they could have, if it wasn't, you know, the end of season 7, you could have had another storyline based on Earth just around that and then being in contact with Voyager. That would be cool.
I didn't gather from the first episode of Star Trek Picard that they had banned sentient holograms because it seems like Captain Picard, well, Admiral Picard, retired Admiral Picard, excuse me, was interacting with something resembling a sentient hologram.
Index.
In Index, exactly. I'm not sure if that was a sentient hologram or one of the mill ordinary holograms.
Debatable.
But it looks like holograms haven't been banned. At least we know that. So.
Yeah. I guess we'll see. Now, one game-changing moment, and I guess you could sort of almost make it a trilogy of game-changing moments, occurs for B'Elanna in the episode Faces, and then you can extend that to Extreme Risk and maybe even Barge of the Dead in terms of her character being changed to the point where something is really, really different about them. You see in Faces that she gets herself split up from the Klingon side and the human side. That really makes her realize that she needs her Klingon side as much as she likes her human side. And then in Extreme Risk, you've got her finding out the loss of the Marquis, or the Marquis lost in the Dominion War, also set her off spiraling. So that, I found, a game-changing moment for B'Elanna.
This is an interesting question, because it strikes me that maybe the Maquis crew members had more in the way of needing to come to terms with who they are and their role in Starfleet, being back in Starfleet or being in Starfleet for the first time. Chakotay had to, you know, become comfortable with being first officer on a Federation starship. Tom Paris, even though he was only in the Maquis a little while, had to become comfortable with being back in Starfleet, having been in prison. B'Elanna has to come to terms not only with her Klingon heritage and her dual ancestry, but also her temperament and her temper and the role that played in being part of the Maquis. So, you know, it seems to me that the Maquis characters had to do a lot more in the way of becoming comfortable with who they are on Voyager than the Starfleet crew members did.
Yeah, I mean, it's just a shame we didn't get to see a lot more conflict and a lot more of that. We saw, I guess, little bits, obviously, like you just said, but it was never really explored enough. And that's something that we all wanted. What else have you got on your list?
This is on my list, and it's related to what we were just talking about. I put Learning Curve, the end of season one, on my list. This tension was coming to a head, and it gets resolved at the end of season one. By season two, everyone's a happy Voyager, members of a happy Voyager family, more or less.
It was mostly resolved by Parallax.
Yeah, it was, essentially. Right? By episode two, they're already getting along famously. But I think of Learning Curve as like this catharsis moment where Tuvok needs to learn to interact with Maquis crew members who don't have Starfleet training. They have to learn to get on board and fall in line and follow the rules. And it all kind of comes to a head and it's resolved in true Voyager fashion. But from that point on, I think you can describe the crew, aside from, folks like Seska, there are one-off rogue elements, so to speak. But other than those, it seems like from that point on, Voyager is essentially one big happy Federation Starfleet family.
Yeah, Learning Curve might not have been, well, let's face it, it was not the best season-ending show. Let's
no,
face
I
it.
Love the episode, but it's pretty lackluster end to season one, for sure.
But it does, as you say, throw up some interesting little bits where the Maquis do have to conform a little bit, but also Tuvok has to learn. And I guess that could be a game-changing moment for him, that he's had to learn to accept that not everyone's going to end up being a Starfleet officer. But if you can sort of come to the middle somewhere, especially being out in the middle of nowhere, you can all get along and work as a team, basically.
Neelix's advice to Tuvok is something I even have to remember as a teacher. You remember that? Remember when Neelix takes that little stem of plant and he bends it until it breaks? And Tuvok's saying, oh, you're saying the Maquis crew members are rigid and inflexible. And he's saying, no, Mr. Vulcan, I'm saying you're rigid and inflexible.
That is one of my favorite scenes of that episode, yeah.
As a teacher, I have to keep that in mind. I can't be rigid and flexible, and inflexible, right?
Do you keep a little plant on your desk at where you teach? To remind yourself of it?
I'm really tempted to actually show a little clip of that in my class now.
Actually, you know what you could do? You could show that and be like, I will not be brittle and inflexible. However, you have to be the same. I like that. You should do it.
In that sense, it really is a growth moment for Tuvok, because he's very rigid and very Vulcan, and he's very rule-based in his thinking. Here's the rules. Why can't they just follow the rules? I'm telling them all the rules. Why can't they just follow the rules? And the Maquis crew members don't have the training to do that, and he's got to bend a bit to get them on board.
Yeah, exactly. So next on my list, I thought of the episode Nightingale, for the purposes of game-changing for Harry Kim, showing that he can actually be a captain of a ship.
You mean an ensign?
Sorry?
You mean an ensign?
No, he was captain of the Nightingale.
He was an ensign captain.
What does that mean?
I don't know. He can do it, but he still doesn't get promoted.
No, I'm just like, but he was captaining that vessel. He was in charge of it. That's what I was meaning. I know he was still an ensign.
He's also in charge of the night shift.
Yeah, but that's
a couple times a week.
That's what I mean. It's different than being in charge of the night shift. It's a whole new ship that he's got to try and control.
In that sense, he had a similar type of character development as Tuvok, because Harry Kim, it's his first command. It's not Voyager, but it's his own ship, essentially, if only for this mission. He's captain or acting captain.
Mm-hmm.
But he ends up alienating a lot of his crew members too because of his behavior as captain. He's got to learn to be flexible as well.
And that's what I mean by a game-changing moment for him, that he learns a lot of what he needs to learn to eventually be made, or at least eventually get promoted. Not necessarily to captain, but you know what I mean. So he learned a whole load of things that would help him excel in his career within Starfleet.
And yet he still doesn't get promoted.
No. See, when I was looking up some bits and pieces, when I was reading about Nightingale, it turns out that at that moment in Season 7, he was almost written off the show again.
In Season 7?
In Season 7, they were going to write him off from Nightingale, let him carry on captaining that ship, and then have him come back in the season finale.
Wow, that's one heck of a promotion to go from ensign to a permanent captain of some alien ship.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's what I read in an article anyway.
Harry might be tempted to do it.
Well, I mean, it would have been good for Garrett Wong. He'd have just had some time off. But that was in like one of the original drafts of the script, apparently. This is what I mean by it was hard to find game-changing moments within the show because of the reset button.
So I have one here, and it's a little belabored, so I hope you'll bear with me.
Okay.
We were talking about Neelix a little bit ago, and for the first couple of seasons of Voyager, I forget exactly when this episode takes place, but up until the episode Fair Trade, when Neelix needs to find a map to continue being the guide for Voyager. Mm-hmm. Neelix is essentially Voyager's guide in a very dangerous quadrant of space, right? Yeah. A couple of months ago, I was actually on Primitive Culture, another show on Trek.fm with Duncan Barrett, and we were talking about Dante in Star Trek, and Dante comes up repeatedly in Voyager. And it occurred to both of us while we were talking about Dante in Star Trek that Neelix is essentially Virgil in Dante's Inferno, leading the main characters on this journey. He as a guide through all of the dangerous, scary things in the Delta Quadrant. And at a certain point, Neelix's ability to be a guide ends because he's at the limits of known space for him. He's out farther than he's ever been, so he can't serve that role as a guide anymore. And it causes a crisis for Neelix. He needs to find a map so he can stay useful, so he can justify being on Voyager. And this is right about the time when Seven of Nine comes on board. It's almost like the transition from Virgil as a guide to Beatrice as a guide inside the Divine Comedy. This is a game-changing moment. Neelix can't be the guide for Voyager anymore. Voyager's in genuine unknown territory and new space at this point. And I think up until that point, even though they were lost, they had Neelix to say, oh, Captain, that's what this is, and here's where you need to go, and follow this path, and don't do this, and you'll be fine. And past this point, Voyager is in genuinely unknown territory.
Well, yeah, I mean, would you prefer a Borg guiding you, or would you prefer a Talaxian like Neelix guiding you?
A Borg.
You prefer a Borg?
Borg has more knowledge, sure.
Well, I mean, they've assimilated. Yeah, but knowing that that knowledge has come from assimilating a whole bunch of cultures?
You saying it's tainted knowledge, kind of like knowledge that comes from, you know, medical experiments that aren't ethical or something like that?
Yeah. What do you think of that?
I don't know. I'm of two minds because, you know, we do want to, you know, have ethical scientific research. But once we have knowledge, it seems weird not to use knowledge that we do have, no matter where it comes from. So the notion that knowledge is tainted based on its origin has always, I've always found particularly problematic. But
Okay. See, because I'd have no issue following it. It's knowledge. Might as well use it.
Yeah, exactly. And it might, you know, that kind of thing might shape restrictions on future knowledge. You know, maybe we shouldn't partner with the Borg like Captain Janeway does in Scorpion. But no, I think once you have knowledge, like once Seven of Nine is on board, no matter how she got her, you know, Borg-acquired knowledge, she's on board and the knowledge exists, it would be silly not to use it, I think.
I suppose another game-changing moment for Star Trek as a franchise is the introduction of Species 8472.
Oh, I'm glad you mentioned that, because I put In the Flesh on my list.
Mm-hmm.
Because for me, Species 8472 is a weird aberration. They're super scary. They're able to beat the Borg. And then, like, all of a sudden, we're friends with them again as a result of In the Flesh. And they're not really that bad. We don't really have to worry about them. And it was one big misunderstanding. And this incredibly awesome, super scary enemy that's able to beat the Borg, like, in the blink of an eye, all of a sudden they're not scary anymore and we're friends with them and the whole tension goes away. It's like they raised all of this tension about Species 8472 just immediately to take it away and make them not a threat. It was such a weird...
It's standard Voyager, though, progression, in a way, isn't
it? It is. They could have ran with Species 8472 for a long time.
Well, that's the thing. I kind of want to do a seven-part series, in a way, onto the journey about specific aliens that could have made a season-long enemy.
And you know, I think part of it is probably just that they were expensive to produce.
Well, yeah, for 1999 or whatever.
For the 1990s, that type of, you know, computer animated characters, that was incredibly time-consuming and detailed to produce. And now it would be no-brainer. Like, oh, yeah, you know, you need an animated alien, no problem. We've got you covered. We'll whip it up for you in 10 minutes, right? I could see why they didn't want to do that every episode just to keep the cost and the production time down.
Well, that's why I see or said that it's a game-changing moment for Star Trek as a franchise, because if I'm not mistaken, it was the first completely CGI alien to be shown on Star Trek, if I'm not mistaken.
Maybe Macrocosm might have that beat.
Yeah, Macrocosm does, but that wasn't exactly a sentient alien, was it? It was like a giant bug thing.
So this is true Voyager fashion. Like they come up with an awesome idea, run with it for a little while, and then all of a sudden, like, they pull the rug out from under it and the whole thing goes away. They did that with Year of Hell. Awesome. dramatic tension, new direction they could have taken the show, and then whoop, at the end of Year of Hell, mm-hmm. it's, you know, none of it really happened. Species 8472, awesome new aliens, they can beat the Borg, we're really afraid of them. Oh, a few episodes later, they're not that bad, and it's just a big misunderstanding, and they kind of go away, and we never hear from them again.
Yeah.
With all of these quote-unquote game-changing moments, I see the lost potential in what Voyager could have done with those concepts and those moments.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why we had such a hard time, because we lose what could be absolute, to say the word, game changers.
Yeah, they could have been genuine game they changers, could have been. Not, you know, wannabe almost game changers.
Like meeting the Hirogen, they didn't have to get rid of the Hirogen after about six episodes. They could have been a foil for the whole entire series. Or, as you said, Species 8472. My favorite's the Voth. Like, they would have been an amazing game-changing.
I'm so glad you mentioned the Voth, because I actually put them on my list here. I've got Distant Origin on my list because they forced us to radically reevaluate and reconcile Earth's entire evolutionary history, like reconceive of Earth's entire evolutionary history.
Well, exactly. I mean, who'd have thought hadrosaurs would have left the planet? And if they carried on with that storyline.
In terms of in-universe, that's got to be a huge game-changer for reconceiving humanity's relationship to its evolutionary history on planet Earth. Spacefaring dinosaurs. I mean, that's amazing. If that's not a game changer, I don't know what is.
Do you know what would make it a decent game changer? Is if they actually then somehow briefly mentioned it in Star Trek Picard, just in the background in like a school or something, you know, like how it was in Children of Mars, have someone in the background teaching about hadrosaurs and then having a picture of the Voth. And so this is what they turned into from 65 million years ago.
You mean Daj wasn't a Voth?
Oh, she could.
Wow, I'm so lost now.
She could well have been. She could have also been Species 8472, but they've gone for android, obviously.
Yeah, I mean, this is true Voyager fashion. Like, you know, okay, Species 8472, they're awesome, they're scary, and then they're so expensive to produce. Even when they're at their dramatic best, they're not even represented in digital form. They're represented in, you know, in humanoid form.
I know that did that. Whilst that was a good episode, like In the Flesh did disappoint me in that way, that we didn't see too much of it.
Oh, I love that episode. I really, really enjoy that episode. It's one of my favorites. I don't know if I've ever mentioned that on To the Journey, but I really enjoy In the Flesh. I think it's so much fun.
The Vaudois fall in the same category as well, I think, in terms of they could have made a really decent... That's Dragon's Teeth.
Oh, yeah. I'm a huge fan of Dragon's Teeth. That's a completely underappreciated episode, I think.
Well, that could have made a decent game changer if they used them properly.
I think Voyager was really successful at introducing new alien species.
Yeah, and also really successful in killing them all. Not killing them all as in physically killing them, but killing off potential prospects of storylines.
Yeah, but they did a good job of giving them enough screen time where you get to know who they are as a people and as characters. Sometimes Star Trek introduces new aliens, new races, and doesn't give you enough to really latch onto. Like, yes, they're visually interesting, you know, they have, you know, the forehead of the week, but there's not enough to really flesh them out. Voyager, really, when they introduce an alien species, generally gives them enough backstory where you get to know who that race is.
Actually, yeah, you are right. So I was just sitting here thinking about some of the other particular ones that we get to see, like the Manaeans, and even one episode they appear, but you seem to know a lot about the Manaeans just from that 40-odd minute episode.
Like in TNG, if there's an alien of the week, there's not enough cultural background to really feel attached to those races in any way, I think.
Yeah, no, I'd agree with that. I mean, obviously there will be some, but I think TNG was very much focused on what Picard or Geordi would do in that episode, as opposed to the viewpoint of the alien species.
Like when alien races are introduced in Enterprise, for example, I'd be hard pressed to say, okay, we've got the Suliban. Are they interesting? Are they as interesting as any of the alien races in Voyager? I don't think so.
I don't think they were. Even though we saw them a fair bit, I don't think they were developed enough.
Right, exactly. So Voyager, even though these races often don't get a lot of screen time, they did a fairly convincing job at conveying enough cultural information for a lot of these species that are introduced in Voyager.
There is one species that I wish we saw a little bit more of, just because we saw 2 years' worth of the Kazon, and that's the Trabe from, I can't remember the episode, something. There were the people who did or enslaved the Kazon, the people that enslaved the Kazon.
Yeah, they didn't get.
They didn't get much of a look in, and it would have been interesting to see just a little bit more on the relationship between the Kazon and the Trabe.
Maybe it's just that the acting is a little better. Like, I'm kind of doing this comparison to TNG. The acting by the crew of the Enterprise in TNG was you know, on its game as always.
Yeah. But
sometimes if it's just like the random alien on the view screen, the acting falls a little flat and it's not terribly memorable. Whereas you do get some, I think, top-notch alien actors inside Voyager.
Yeah, and do you know what? I reckon that's pretty much a byproduct of the fact that we've had TNG for 7 years and DS9 for a couple of years, that they just know what's expected and what they need from an alien character. I don't have any other game-changing episodes for the show, but I guess you could also, if we're going to go talking about character game-changing moments, you've got Heroes and Demons, where the Doctor is brought out of sickbay for the first time, even in that stupid episode. I mean, I don't like that episode. I mean, yeah.
Oh, really? See, I like all things, you know, classic literature. So
yeah, I knew you'd like it.
Yeah, I like it just because of that. I'm not sure if it's a great episode, but I like just the fact that it's about Beowulf.
Schmollis Frühling.
So interesting. Aw.
Yeah, see, I don't like the episode. I just find it boring. A little bit. No, I can't even say that, really, because it wasn't boring. It's hard for me to say. It's just not my favourite episode, but it does bring the Doctor out of sickbay for the first time. And that's the very beginning of him starting to integrate with the crew and being a little bit more respected by the crew. So you could say that that's a game-changing moment for the Doctor.
What are some other game-changing moments for the Doctor? Can you think of his crucial moments of character development?
Oh, definitely Virtuoso.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, I mean, it he needed to be brought down a peg.
who doesn't want an opera singing Doctor? I mean, I'd hate one.
And the fun size version.
Yeah, mini doctor.
Yeah.
Well, he was made mini actually in another episode, season 1 or something. When
oh, that's right, he was.
Yeah, but this just goes back to,
and then we had shrinking Doctor, of course.
Right? Yeah. This just goes back to the fact that the Doctor and Seven are the most developed characters in all of the show. I mean, Captain Janeway has her own development as well, but nowhere near as much as Jerry Ryan and Robert Picardo got to play with.
I very nearly put Knight on the
Me
list
too.
For Captain Janeway's
Me too.
Character development, because this is when she really has a deep, deep crisis about her role in Stranding Voyager in the Delta Quadrant. Lack of confidence, just wants to retreat and hide in her quarters, feels completely responsible for the lives around her, and she just almost can't take it anymore. And is that a moment of character development? I mean, something that, you know, it's almost like a wave of depression. It comes and then it went away for her. It's, you know, it doesn't really linger on past that. Maybe this is a moment getting past that for her. Maybe that's what the real moment is, where
I think so.
You know, this needed to come to a head.
Maybe
she
not.
Needed to feel that and move beyond it.
I don't want to make light at all of how deep a depression she must have got herself into, because we've only seen it for, you know, 10% of a 40-minute show, I guess, when that could have been, how long were they out there? For like 5 months or something, she must have been feeling that way. So she went through a pretty big bout of depression. I wouldn't necessarily say it's her getting over it, because I have a feeling that that's something that she would never get over, managing to strand everyone out there. But it was good to see that the show actually showed Janeway having a crack in that respect, like a crack in her armor. Do you know what I mean?
Well, I think this is an overall game-changing transition moment, maybe for the show in general, but also for each individual character in his or her own way. I think each character, maybe except for Harry, who really just desperately wants to get home to the Alpha Quadrant, each character makes this transition from, we're stranded in the Delta Quadrant, we have to get home to Earth, to home is really on Voyager,
yeah.
No matter where they're at. And I think each character does that in a different way. Again, maybe except for Harry, who just wants to get home the entire time. They all want to get home, but they all start to feel like Voyager is their home, even though they're on this mission to get back home to Earth. And that's a transition for the show. At a certain point, the tone of the show changes from, oh my God, we have to get home, to Voyager really is its own family and they are home. And Tom Paris says as much. He says, I don't want to get home, Harry. I am home.
Well, I mean, that was very much late in season 7, I think, wasn't it? Where do you think the point in the show is where that becomes a reality to them?
Well, I think it varies by character. That's a really interesting question. I would say it's somewhere in the latter part of the show.
Oh, yeah.
Season 5, season 6, season 7.
I reckon Chakotay, it would be much earlier than Janeway. For Tom, it's much earlier than, well, I mean, Harry never gets over it until pretty much right at the very end in Endgame.
Mm-hmm.
Tuvok, no one knows what Tuvok thinks.
B'Elanna doesn't really want to get back home either.
No. So you're not going to, I think a lot of those people on that ship, except for potentially Harry and Janeway out of maybe guilt, doesn't actually want to get home at all. Seven doesn't want to be there. The Doctor has no need to be home. Tuvok, yeah, he's got his kids, but he's just doing his job. Tom doesn't want to be home.
All of the Maquis have criminal charges hanging over their heads, essentially.
Exactly. And so maybe that's the one of the whole points of the show. They don't actually want to get home. They do want to get home, but they do.
Well, they say they want to get home, but maybe they don't really believe it as much as they say they do.
So they do want to get home, but that's just out of needing to strive towards something. So, yeah, that's an interesting point. I've never thought of it before.
I'm not sure I can identify a point in this show. Maybe it is night. Maybe it's just at a certain point, Captain Janeway's like, ugh.
That's probably the biggest moment for Janeway.
I'm depressed. And then from there, I don't really feel that melancholy about being stuck in the Delta Quadrant from anyone later in the show.
Yeah. I do feel like she had that on her shoulders far more than I would have done. I think I would have just been like, well, I've made a decision. Not a great decision, potentially, but I can see what I've done. Let's just carry on and march on through. But then again, who's to say? Because we're not in space and we're never going to be.
My secret hope for Voyager was always that they were going to turn it into more like a generational ship. Like,
yeah, definitely. You know,
like if I were writing Voyager right now, like reconceiving it, I would make each season like a different decade, like show the progression of time over 70 years.
See, we could have just done that with Kes as a character, though. I know I said it probably a million times in the last 5 episodes. Kes could have shown us what that would have been within the 7-year period. So, you know, we all know my opinions on Kes and how much I liked the character.
Does Kes have a game-changing moment? Well, for her, of course,
gosh,
sort
yes.
of discovering her...
She has powers.
Superpowers, for lack of a better word.
Kes, the Marvel character of Voyager. She'll have her own origin story soon.
Super-O.
Super-Kes.
Super-O-Compan.
It's only for Kes. It's only in the shows where she finds her superpowers where is probably her game-changing moment.
I would say for her, the biggest game-changing moment is ending her relationship with Neelix, right?
Thankfully.
She becomes a more autonomous person once she, you know, she and Neelix break up.
Well, I mean, she just like a lot of other characters, she grew personally on that show quite quickly.
Well, she had to have this lifespan of 9 years. So what's your view on Voyager game-changing moments at the end of the day? You know, for me, I feel like for every game-changing moment, you know, that's 20% of it, and the other 80% is the lost potential.
Do you know what? I fully agree with you there. There was a lot of lost potential, and everyone's already brought that up in the past about Voyager. And the fact that we've struggled within the show to create some game-changing moments for the course and the direction of Voyager, it just proves that point, really.
I also think that Voyager, in a way, was a game-changing moment for Star Trek because I feel like TNG and, to some extent, Deep Space Nine kind of got away from the original vision of Star Trek, which is being out on the frontier in the unknown, encountering all of the dangers and all of the unknowns and all of the things you have to discover. You know, we've talked about this metaphor before, the wagon train to the stars, but imagine what it was like to be on a wagon train coming across the, you know, the United States moving west in a wagon, right? There's Indians and, you know, there's famine and there's disease and there's all of this danger. You might get shot, you might die, you might starve, you might freeze. It was dangerous, right?
Yeah.
And it was unknown. It was new territory. And by TNG, the Alpha Quadrant was so well known that there wasn't much in the way of frontier, right?
Yeah.
And with Deep Space Nine, they're essentially stuck on a space station. So it wasn't frontier either. It was all political, but there wasn't frontier. And in Voyager, there's a frontier again. Space is new and it's dangerous. And it's and at every turn, there's something novel that they have to deal with. So I think of Voyager as kind of a return to Star Trek's original vision of being out there on the frontier and a game changer in that sense, kind of correcting the course from the direction that TNG and Deep Space Nine took Star Trek in.
Bringing back what the original concept of the show was. I mean, TNG
yes,
played...
exactly.
TNG and DS9 played really well on the utopian vision of it all, but you're right in the respect that Voyager really was out there in the middle of nowhere trying to find or finding new... well, seeking new life and new civilizations. Let's face it, that's what they were doing. Although they weren't seeking them out as such, they were passing by.
And it's weird because the frontier for Voyager, it's like they've already arrived. They're already on the other side of the galaxy. It's like it's almost as if Lewis and Clark were transported to the to the Pacific Coast and had to make their journey back to Washington D.C. or something. Yeah. It's such a weird idea. But at every turn, you know, the space in between is genuinely unknown space. And I think the early seasons of TNG actually did that pretty well. Like season one of TNG, there's a lot of unknown territory and they are, you know, encountering new phenomena, and then it becomes very political and they're just ferrying diplomats around more or less. But
on that giant cruise ship.
In Voyager, they're literally on a new frontier, unknown space. They've got to map it as they go. And, you know, I just think of that as the spirit child of the original series.
Yeah, I'll take that.
So game-changing in that sense, you know, just a course correction, bringing back the vision of Star Trek to its original concept. Mm.
That's probably the biggest game-changing moment for the franchise that Voyager can provide.
Just like you coming on board to the Journey is a game-changing moment for us.
Liam. Oh, God, I wouldn't go that far.
You've changed the game on us.
Oh, some of the things that come out of my mouth, I swear you regret it sometimes. Suzanne has a lot of fun probably editing out some of the weird stuff that comes out.
Oh, if you listeners only knew the things we have to edit out from Liam already.
Oh, yep, we've had some of those interesting ones today, haven't we? Although I do think Kes would make a good superhero. She's like Voyager's Emma Frost. Sorry, I just got it. She's Voyager's Emma Frost.
What do you mean?
Do you know Emma Frost from X-Men?
Oh, okay.
Minus the diamond thing. Sorry.
Well, that's the thing about Star Trek in general. Star Trek, on the one hand, is ostensibly science fiction. It's more like pure science fiction than like fantasy. On the other hand, at many times in Star Trek, these pure fantasy elements get mixed in with the science fiction elements. So yeah, a superhero Kes, you know, it's science fiction, and somehow, you know, we don't get too offended when Star Trek goes in the fantasy direction as opposed to the science fiction direction.
I mean, Voyager does air into some weird fantastical moments. Just look at what happened in Bride of Chaotica. I mean, that was a whole creation by the crew. That's about as fantastical as I can think of right now.
Yeah, and Star Trek, for all of its, you know, its techno-babble and its, you know, techno-futurism and techno-utopianism, likes to hand-wave on the science a lot. So it's not like pure science fiction, right?
Do you know hand-waving is the best way to deal with theoretical physics? You just hand-wave it all away. So they've got the science pretty down pat by just hand-waving.
Yeah, that's what theoretical physicists do, right? They go, you know, quarks, string theory, or string's real. We don't know. It's like, the math works out, so we're happy.
Exactly. As long as the math works, or you just make up the math to do it, which I have done before.
Well, Liam, it's been a lot of fun talking about weird and risky Voyager game-changing moments, but this isn't the only thing we've been discussing here on the network, so here's a quick look at some of the other things you may have missed elsewhere on Trek.fm.
Previously on Trek.fm, The Line, a Star Trek Picard podcast.
A concern that a lot of people brought up was that when you see Utopia Planitia, there's several Discovery-era ships that you see there.
I don't understand how people can have a problem with that.
But let's talk about
it
a little bit. Because
how long was the Excelsior class around for?
Yeah, that's my point as well. There's also a TOS shuttle in Generations in the 24th century and a bunch. And there could be like a story reason for that, right?
Earl Grey.
There's one point that annoys me, and it's using the transporter to reverse the whole thing. And they find a hair on her brush. That's in the, like, why would you keep your hairbrush in the back of the second drawer down?
I don't know. I'm sure people do it today.
No, I keep my hairbrush in a drawer.
In the back of the second drawer down, though. Like, she's got, like, eight
there
drawers.
There may be items more important in the top drawer.
So, Joe, you're worried about like the drawer placement the and the part of the drawer? I love that.
Primitive Culture, a look at history and culture through Star Trek.
You can go back and you can see a lot of the familiar arguments that we associate with modern Star Trek fandom playing out in fandom in real time in the 90s through fanzines like Cine Fantastique, for example. And what happens during the second season, if you read the interviews on various episodes, is that you see writers and people working on the show using the magazine in order to advance their own narrative of the production of Voyager.
Standard Orbit.
The season as a whole is just this tremendous journey. It's a roller coaster that, when you get to Operation Annihilate, takes a very sharp drop very suddenly, but at least it's over very quickly. But like as it goes, you're ramping up and up and up and up, and it's just it's amazing to watch in those terms. So that would probably be why it would be maybe my fourth favorite Star Trek season ever.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out all these shows and join the conversation about your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button in Apple Podcasts on your iPhone, iPad, Apple TV, or the desktop iTunes app to get the latest episodes as soon as they are published. And please leave us a star rating and a written review. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Google Play Music, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, in most third-party podcast apps, and you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website or grab the RSS link as well.
We'd love to hear your thoughts on today's show, and there are many ways for you to share your thoughts with us. The best place to join in the larger conversation is the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type Babel, B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook and it should come right up. If you'd like to send us an email, you can use the form on our website at trek.fm/contact, choose Message to a Trek FM Show, and select To the Journey. That will come right to us. You can also find the network on Twitter at TrekFM and on Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM. So, Zachary, when you're not popping your head out of fluidic space pretending to be a Species 8472 person, or alien, where can we find you on the internet?
Well, you can find me elsewhere on Trek.fm as co-host of MetaTrek's Trek FM show dedicated to Star Trek and philosophy. And you can also follow me on Twitter. My handle is just my name, at Zachary Fruhling. That's Zachary, Z-A-C-H-A-R-Y, Fruhling, F-R-U-H-L-I-N-G. And how about you, Liam? When you're not busy advocating for holographic rights, where can our listeners find you on the interwebs and around the Trek FM network?
So you can find me on Twitter at LS74656. On the Babel Conference, and also on The Edge, Trek FM's Star Trek Discovery podcast.
Well, if you'd like to help us keep all of our shows coming to you each week, we invite you to become a patron of the network on Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, to get all the details. Perks include early access to episodes, exclusive content, producer credits, and many more, all available through our special patrons website, the Patron Zone. It requires a great deal of money to produce, host, and distribute these podcasts each month. We really appreciate any support you can give us, and we hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm.
So got some acknowledgements we'd like to make. Firstly, C. Brian Jones, founder and publisher of Trek FM, who is actually a Voth. Executive producers Matthew Rushing and Kenneth Tripp. Aaron Hartvey, our art director, and Richard Marquez, the production manager. We'd also like to thank our associate producers, Bruce Lish, G. Kim, Richard Marquez, Patrick Carling, and Norman Lau.
You know, Liam, I just had a thought. I realized that I forgot to include one of the game-changing moments, one of the most important game-changing moments, which I consider Message in a Bottle, when Starfleet Command learns that Voyager is not genuinely lost for good.
Oh my God, how did we forget that? Oh, that is an
Voyager
amazing
is
moment.
Not alone. That's a huge game-changing moment for Voyager. That changes the entire tone of Voyager, gives them hope that they're going to get home.
Oh my God. I can't believe we forgot that. Yeah, no, that does give them a lot of hope. That was a massive
It was literally on the screen in front of me and I forgot to mention it.
And you know, I've just thought of another one. Pathfinder.
What is it?
When they eventually talk to them face-to-face.
Exactly. That it's in the same spirit.
Yeah. I mean, that's probably the biggest game-changing moment of the whole entire show, and we forgot about it. Wow.
So much for such good it does to write these things down.
Yeah, should wing it.
Next time, I'm not even going to bother making notes. Can't even remember my notes.
And that'll be your stinger next week on TTJ. We'll see what we forget.
Well, be sure to join us next time when we will be promoting Harry Kim, the biggest game changer of all. But until then, this has been To the Journey.